Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with Goals.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I am delighted because joining me this week before he takes a four-week hiatus for no doubt very, very valid personal reasons, it's Rory K. Smith. Also joining me, somebody who is most definitely not going into rehab over the next 4 weeks, it's Julian Lawrence. And joining us remotely from Vilnius, which has I'm sure has either been or will be at some point a European capital of culture, it's Matt Dickinson. Coming up, we'll be discussing the start of the Klopp era at Anfield, the ongoing follies at FIFA, and the usual quick hits. But first, let's discuss some Euro qualifiers. Dicko, let's start with you. For England, it's been a drama-free, a largely drama-free qualifying campaign, right? 9 wins out of 9. They beat Estonia. They're going to play Lithuania, which is why you're in Vilnius. It's been understated because nothing's gone wrong and nobody's been in danger. That's all a good thing, right?
Well, it's sort of a good thing, except for the fact that, you know, you need tests to work out your best team. You need tests to know how far you're getting. You need tests to, you know, just to get a realistic semblance of where you are in the world. And England haven't had that. We're in the weird position of sort of bring on the friendlies because the FA have lined up some decent ones, Spain and Germany and some proper teams to play. So, you know, we want to bring those games on because we need to see where England are at. And you know, this campaign has been smooth, but are we closer to knowing what England's best lineup is, what their best strategy is, what their best tactics are? We're not, because and that's not all Hodgson's fault. He's had some pretty rotten luck with injuries. Durridge and Wilshere, obviously, and Henderson. So we're in a sort of calm position. But actually, you know, if you're talking about how we're going to play the first big game of next summer, that's still very much up in the air.
Well, we're going to be getting to that. And just in case, I'm going to help guys out who maybe haven't prepared for the show as fully as they did. In a few minutes, I will be asking you. I'm not looking at you, Rory. I'm just looking in general around the room. I'll be asking you for your best 11. For the opening day of the Euro. We'll get to that in a minute. Julian, Hodgson says he's going to send out an interesting team, which I think is a euphemism for saying he's going to try out players who maybe haven't been England regulars and whatnot. Do you get the sense that he's kind of just going through the motions and that 90 minutes with a bunch of guys who are also new to the team and whatever, he's going to learn more from the training sessions perhaps with players than by actually seeing them play?
I think there's a bit of both, and I think the game against Lithuania is important in a way because after that you've got, you know, November, you play France in a friendly, for example, which would probably you're going to put your strongest 11. And after that you've got March, two friendlies in March, and after that it's your final squad of 23. So if you want to, it's probably one of the last, or the last, really, game where you can put out a very inexperienced team with young players or with players that have very few caps with them and see what they can do, especially away from home, in a small stadium, not the great conditions, and see what they're about. And I think that's what Deschamps did in Denmark, for example, with France on Sunday night after putting his strongest team in the first game against Armenia. And I think that would be the idea for Hodgson, to see where those players are right now and see already thinking about his squad of 23 for the Euros.
For all that it's been a very kind of easy and sort of smooth sailing qualification campaign, I think the one thing maybe you would have wanted Hodgson to do a little bit more is when the game still mattered, even after it became fairly obvious that England would not qualify without any problems at all. He maybe sort of chucks in a couple of the more fringe players to see how they fare under more pressurised situations.
In meaningful games.
Yeah, because ultimately, I agree with Jules completely, but who's about to eat a pan au chocolat?
No.
I agree with him completely that I think there is a validity to throwing in kind of 11 fringe players against Lithuania, but whether it's a meaningful test of any sort, I don't know. So maybe, you know, two or three could have played against Slovenia away, which would have been a much tougher game, even Switzerland at home. Do you know what I mean? You could have maybe gambled a little bit more in those fixtures, yeah, because it was obvious.
He's the England manager. He kind of knows the way the media works.
Yeah,
you can't really blame him for that, right?
Yeah.
Dicko, you don't blame him for not playing the fringe players, for not adopting the Rory Casemate.
Well, we've seen 31 players, I think it'll be, by tonight in this qualifying, and you know, sometimes with these stats that come through about the lack of English players in the Premier League, you're quite surprised to hear there are 31. But you know, I mean, the pool, the trouble with England obviously is the thinness of it, isn't it? I mean, we're not, you know, if we lose Wilshere, it's not like we've got two or three just like Wilshere, or if we lose a particular player, it's not, you know, like other nations more blessed with abundance. We don't have sort of lots of similar options of similar calibre. And that's the problem when you start getting down talking about sort of fringe players. Well, you know, Jonjo Shelvey, you know, I just don't think he's going to be good enough. And yet he's starting a qualifying game away. So, you know, say some of that circumstances has been forced on him. But, you know, the fact is we need to, as best we can, get to see something like a first 11 on the pitch. And see how they click.
Speaking of that first 11, this is the dreaded moment I told you would come. It's the opening game of the Euros, and I want to hear your England 11. I'm going to start with you, Julian. And Julian, I'd like you to pretend that you want what you think is the best England 11, not just the England 11 that French people would love to see, because it'll stink it up and be terrible.
Okay. So I go for Joe Hart in goal. I go for Klein at right back. We assume that everybody is fit.
We assume that everybody is fit.
Except maybe Luke Shaw, because he's unlikely to be fit.
He wouldn't have... So Joe Hart in goal, Klein at right back, Baines at left back. In the centre, I go for Stones and Smalling. I play 4-2-3-1. In my two midfields, I've got Wilshere and Henderson. I've got Barkley behind Sturridge. And I've got Sterling on one side. And I've got Theo Walcott, on the other side, with Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain on the bench, Rooney on the bench, Kane on the bench.
Wow.
Jones on the bench.
No Rooney, no Hurricane, no?
I think Ross Barkley, for me, is in better form right now than when Rooney. If everybody's fit, you know, we said everybody fit, so that means in my head that Sturridge would have had a good run of games under Klopp at Liverpool. I think for me, it starts up front.
Rory?
Hart, Klein... I would say, are we doing the ones we think it will be, or what we would say?
The one that you think it should be. I would say
Smalling and Stones. With
no love for Jags and his experience, no.
I think he's great to have in the squad, but I think Smalling's actually been one of the best players in
Jones?
England this year. Yeah.
Smalling, Phil Jones?
No, Stones.
Stones. Okay, sorry.
Smalling and Stones. Kieran Gibbs at left back.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And assuming that everybody's fit.
You'd have Gibbs ahead of Baines.
Apart from Luke Shaw is fit. Yeah, I think if Shaw's fit, which I don't think he will be, then I think Shaw plays. But yeah, I'd have Gibbs ahead of Baines. Then I think Hodgson wants to play 4-3-3, but I don't think he's got the players to do it, to be honest. So I think it'll be 4-2-3-1 with Milner and Henderson in midfield, the creative option.
No passer in midfield then?
No, I think he might... Initially, does a Wilshere's injuries, I think he might...
So Wilshere's fully fit in this scenario.
Jack Wilshere is never fully fit.
Are you not listening to the rules?
All right.
You said assuming everybody's fit and has played.
Wilshere and... All right, if everyone is fully fit, fitter than Jack Wilshere has ever been, then Wilshere and Milner with Oxlade-Chamberlain on the right, Rooney in the hole, Sterling on the left, and Sturridge up front.
Again, no love for the Hurricane. Okay. Dicko, you obviously watch more of England than any of us.
Oh, aren't I spoiled?
So no pressure there.
we're pretty similar, I reckon. Hart, Klein, Smalling, Stones, left back is the problem. I mean, and Gibbs is a risky choice. Bertrand only come back from injury, not done enough. I mean, if Shaw's got any chance of being fit, I'd have taken Ashley Cole to the last World Cup. So that's I think left back we're struggling. I think Wilshere and Henderson midfield. I think Walcott, Rooney and Sterling. This is assuming Rooney has played his way into form this season. And Sturridge just probably ahead of Kane at the top of it.
If you remember back to the Switzerland game away in Basel, he played the three in midfield, didn't he, with Delph. And I think against better quality opposition, it's no point speculating who they play in the first game, but there will be at least one other decent team in their group.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I thought Delph was actually a pretty important part of this when fit. Obviously, he's out now, but you know, in our scenario, everybody's fit.
But then you have the other issue of will Delph, how much will Delph play at City? You don't know. You do have Henderson and Milner are basically the same player, but one's 5 years older than the other.
You really think that?
I think they're very similar. Yeah, they offer a very similar skill set.
We've got this perfect record, and yet we're a million miles from knowing the best team. He played a lot of the qualifying with a diamond with Wilshere at the bottom, and I don't think he'd do that against anyone half decent. We've seen one formation, then we've tried another, and we probably think he'll go back to something that we tried 2 years ago. This is why, maybe in Roy's head there is absolute clarity about the team he wants to play, but that clarity has yet to be shown to the rest of us.
The diamond's not a bad option, though, is it? Because you play Wilshere at the base, you have Milner and Henderson running, and then you have Sterling at the tip. That's not...
I'm not sure. I don't think Arena Euros playing diamond midfield.
I'm not sure I care enough about the England formation.
Wilshere can play there anyway. It's always been a forced debate for me.
Dico, just to wrap this up, I mean, we mentioned Wayne Rooney, and I obviously you talked about him playing his way back into the team. Do you think that maybe at some point in his development, Rooney stopped seeing football in quite the same way, and instead of regarding the game as the one that he played as a child, with a bottle of squash on the side of the road and enjoying his heart, it became something else to him?
Do people think that Rooney could be in decline, that this season could be very, very, very average, and then that could become a big issue?
No, people have been saying it for the last 5 years, and he doesn't decline. And you know why he doesn't decline? Because for all the crap that people say about him, he is objectively, I think, as technically skillful as almost any other English striker.
No, but that, there's not, right? When he'd be 45, he'd still be skillful. That's, I don't think
precisely,
that's the issue.
Right? Yeah, so you're talking about what? The athleticism?
No, I'm talking like...
Why would he decline?
What kind of job? Well, if he's not decisive, if he doesn't score, if he doesn't give an assist, if he's very...
But he does continue scoring and giving assists. Look at the numbers from last season.
But I'm talking about this season. So far with United, you can't tell me that he's been super decisive. We've seen him more transparent than anything else.
Which of United's attacking players have played well this season, apart from Martial and tiny spurts?
True, Mata. That's not my point. My point
Mata
is
Mata, who plays from a standstill and sprays the ball around because the guy can't run. I mean, I don't. This continuous, like, self harm. There's something wrong with Rooney and this and that.
Listen,
he's going to become Gaza. Enough.
No, I said I love Rooney. I'm just saying that could he become an issue? Comes June, where he obviously be the captain and in the 23-man squad. But the question is, do we play him or not? Does he bring enough?
The question you're asking, and we'll ask Roy and we'll ask Dicko, because he's probably best placed to answer, is if Rooney doesn't merit a place in the side, does Roy Hodgson have the cojones to drop him?
Well, this is what we've been longing for from England managers for a while, isn't it? No sacred cows. I mean, it's, you know, we've been stuck with it. And again, it's just down to the shortage of... Yeah, the lack of options has been a problem, and that's compounded the sense that, you know, star players are picked automatically. And on the one hand, it's a Rooney issue and a Hodgson issue, because you've got to have the cojones to do it. But it's also a broader England issue of having the confidence in, you know, Plan B, Plan C and Plan D. And I'm afraid we haven't had the talent pool to push the star players enough.
Well, if you have Sturridge and Kane on... in rich veins of form towards the end of the season.
Or Walcott, since Walcott is now a striker, right?
Then you do... But Walcott, you can fit into a side. Even if Walcott's playing as a striker for Arsenal, Hodgson would get away with saying, right, he's on form, he plays right wing for England. People would accept that. But if Sturridge and Kane are both playing really well, both scoring goals, and Rooney's playing like a drain, and Hodgson decides that he wants to play 4-3-3, that's when it becomes an issue. If you can put Rooney in the hole, then Rooney will play in the hole.
I think Barkley is an amazing talent, and I think he would be, if he continues the season that he's had so far, I think he'd be crazy not to at least give him a chance to start the Euros.
Let's move on to some of the other qualifiers. As you guys know, I love this qualifying campaign. If I don't sound very excited about international break, it's because I don't get excited about international breaks. However, relative to other Euro qualifying campaigns, I think this one's been fantastic because there's games to watch every single day for 6 days in a row. You can either watch good teams against who have already qualified against bad teams, and you can actually watch them because they're not all at the same time. And there are a lot of exciting games. That Poland-Ireland, last night, that was exciting. If you're a neutral, you've got people playing for stuff, and that's all pretty cool. But Rory, we've all talked about the wonderful fairy tale story of Iceland, and here's an equivalent fairy tale story. Albania, the country that once sort of years ago officially decided that God didn't exist, that's all changed. They've reinstated God. And look, lo and behold, they qualify for the Euros.
Are you drawing a direct parallel between their decision to reinstate God and they're finally reaching a major championship final?
I know, sort of kind of all about correlation and causality, and maybe the two things aren't related, but let me put it this way, it certainly didn't hurt. Neither did appointing an Italian manager, I might add.
No,
yeah,
so I
did a great job.
I was in Albania last week for their game against Serbia, which, as fans of riots will know, was the reverse fixture of the Damien Belgrade last year, which ended with a drone being flown onto the pitch. Flying.
So I have to ask, because James Montague, who was at the game, he kept tweeting that there was a sniper on the roof.
The Albertson Arena is quite small, it's quite low slung, and there's three tower blocks that overlook it. And the Interior Ministry of Albania told all the residents they weren't allowed on their balconies, they had to stay away from their windows, and they weren't allowed to permit guests from midday on the day of the game. They shut down the tower blocks. They shut all the roads around. They shut the road from Tirana to Elbasan at 12 o'clock. The game kicks off at 8:45 local time. And it was all to avoid trouble, because Albanians and Serbs don't like each other because of the thorny issue of Kosovo, right? So Albania lost the game to Serbia, which was everyone was very disappointed, this sort of eerie silence. But fortunately, for those of us who were quite touched by the Albanian stories, it's a very small country, it's a very poor country, they've never been to a major finals before. They then won in Armenia last night on Sunday, which means they have leapfrogged the mighty Danes, bringing to a close Morten Olsen's international career. And they have qualified for their first ever major finals, and it's wonderful.
With a team that's actually, I mean, the sort of the Albanian Kosovo diaspora is enormous, so for Switzerland, whatever. But by the same token, like, you look at this starting 11, it's a pretty crummy team.
They're not great, I will.
And yet, in terms of individual talent, so should we be praising their Italian manager?
They had.
And his assistant, Paolo Tramezzani, former Tottenham legend, Paolo Tramezzani.
They had.
George Graham's sworn enemy.
Two or three quite talented individuals. The most famous names to English listeners will be Lorit Schanner, who used to play for Sunderland, who's now at Nantes. They've got two or three playing Serie A. Quite a lot who play in Switzerland, including Talent Xhaka, who is Granit Xhaka's brother.
Not as good, despite his name.
Not as good. They're not brilliant. They're quite kind of tight and compact, and they're decent from set pieces. So DiBiase, the manager, has done a brilliant job. But what's really interesting is that half of the side, the 28 players I think they called up, 13 were born in Albania, 14 were born in Kosovo, and one was born in Germany. So it's this once-in-a-lifetime thing, because obviously Kosovo, next year, should get UEFA membership.
Yeah, and have a national team.
Which means that in the future, members of the Kosovar diaspora who currently elect to play for Albania may well...
Or Switzerland.
May well elect to play for Kosovo instead of Albania. And that means that Albania have had this sort of expanded pool of players really for the first and only time in their history. So this was their one shot at getting to a final. And they did it. It's great.
We hear about national teams coming together and being greater than the sum of their parts. Is there a parallel there, perhaps, a little bit with the between Albania and the Republic of Ireland, who of course beat Germany and then suffered that late heartbreaking loss to Poland?
You know, I was skeptical about the expansion of the tournament, and still, I mean, until we've actually seen the tournament itself, you know, we can't be sure how it's going to play out. But I think what it has done is give hope to a lot of nations that, you know, I mean, we're very alive to it because of the home nations and the Republic of Ireland suddenly, you know, being some of the big winners of expansion, because, you know, it's changed the ambitions, the hopes, aspirations of the middle group of European nations, or middle to lower group of European nations. Whether that would last if it wasn't so sort of alive to us is an interesting thought.
Mm. But who do you think is not going to be happy about it?
Well, until we've seen the tournament itself, I mean, one of the joys to me of the Euros was the fact that, you know, you tended to lurch straight into huge games. I mean, it felt sort of you know, knockout sort of, you know, football right from the start, you tend to get a Portugal v France or a, you know, Germany v Holland right at the beginning. You tend to have that sense of, you know, this is incredibly immediate, big games, you know, big nations under pressure right from the start. I suspect there'll be a dilution of that. I mean, that's almost certain that there'll be a dilution of that. Now, whether that actually affects the tournament will have to be seen. I mean, whether, you know, we'll be excited about, can Wales cause an upset? We'll be excited about Northern Ireland causing an upset. So, say, from a home nation point of view, we might actually still think the Euros itself are fantastic, but the finals were always going to be the bit of this that was affected potentially for the worst, not qualifying.
There's two things I think that are quite interesting. One is that Dicko's right that it may well be that you might get like a Germany-Albania. You might get a couple of weaker groups in the finals where there are more straightforward games than there normally are in the Euros. I think the new knockout round might be slightly worse than the quarterfinals. That was the Euros' selling point, but a lot of the teams who qualified, who were smaller countries in inverted commas, would have qualified anyway because they've won their groups. Do you know what I mean? They've done through automatically. It's not
right, so they're not as bad as you think they are. Just yes. You don't recognize. Whereas teams like Holland are in serious danger of not qualifying. In fact, will almost certainly not qualify.
Yeah, but not even Holland. Like Turkey, Sweden might not qualify.
Well, I think when one out of Holland or Turkey will get to the playoffs and presumably qualified.
But just now, for us in France, because I'm here, I'm you know, I'm representing the Euros in my country. It's, you know, it's great because we'll have a million Brits coming over in the summer, which is going to be great. I think the atmosphere...
It was fantastic last time in Marseille. They loved it.
It was brilliant. Great day out. Yeah.
It was not their fault. But, you know, I think we're very happy in France to have the extended version of the Euros. Although, like, you know, Rory and Dicko said, I think the Euros used to be more difficult to win than the World Cup because you had such a concentration of strong teams in a way. I know you disagree, but I think the Euros were always
tougher. Euros were never more difficult to win than the World Cup. It's just an absolute nonsense.
I don't think it is. Players used to say it.
You can get a player to say, come on, we've all spoken to players. You can get a player to say just about anything.
Yeah, but you can't disagree with what Dicko says, that the difference between the Euros was that you went straight into those big games.
That part, well, first of all, I agree with Dicko that that's how a lot of people feel. It's not how I feel. It's not exciting for me to see supposedly big countries. Like, remember the last Euros? Like, was it Holland and Germany in the same group?
France and England. Yeah, but
France, so what? I mean,
but
like,
just take the groups of the World Cup, the group stages of the World Cup and of the Euros. There's no debate that the ones at the Euros are far more competitive than the one, which is normal.
But that's not true because you saw it at the last World Cup, where simply because you can't name any Costa Rican players except for Keylor Navas and Brian Ruiz, then Costa Rica go and finish ahead of
Joel Campbell.
Sorry,
Oscar Duarte.
Stop it! You had to pull out the Oscar Duarte. Okay, but then Costa Rica go and they whoop Italy and England and they finish ahead of them.
It doesn't mean that you can have upsets at the World Cup.
No, but it's not upsets. This notion that it has to be an upset because you don't know these people.
No, it's the same thing. You do know them, but you don't tell me that on paper.
Tell me that Costa Rica beating Italy is not an upset.
Come on, don't tell me you saw this one coming.
No, but what I would say is that the gap, we fall prey to the hype and we don't understand. We still can't wrap our heads around it, that this isn't the FA Cup we're talking about. That once you get into the competitive game, the gap between the players that we all know and recognize and the guys that we've never heard of because they play in Central America or whatever really isn't that great. And evidence of this is when the World Cup went to 24 teams into 32 teams, right? There were people saying like, oh, look, you know, Brazil will beat Zaire 9-0. Well, other than Saudi Arabia on several occasions, and I believe Honduras, was it Hungary and...
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In El Salvador in 1982, which is before Rory was even born.
It wasn't, it was the year I was born.
But unless you go that far back, there aren't that many upsets. There aren't that many one-sided games. You go and you look at the number of games that have been won by 3 goals in major competition at the World Cup, and it's actually very, very few.
Oh, it's not about the shocks. It's just about the intensity, isn't it? The sense of, you know, yeah, it's just a more compact, intense tournament. But I'd say let's hope the Euros are great, and you know.
Yeah, I'll tell you what though. If Spain are playing Northern Ireland and they're 1-0 up in the 80th minute, which if you look at how many goals Spain score in major tournaments, is not unlikely. It will be just as intense and just as exciting, I think, because of the possibility that there'll be a set piece or something in Northern Ireland will score. And simply because Spain are better by many magnitudes in Northern Ireland, I think it'll still be a tight, exciting game. Liverpool have a new manager, and it's Jurgen Klopp. Not much of a surprise there. We've kind of gone over this a little bit. I actually liked Rory's theory last week when we talk about the much maligned transfer committee and how it's really no different than the way many clubs do business. It's just that they call it a transfer committee, or maybe they don't even call it. Do Liverpool actually call it a transfer committee, or is it just something the media has created?
I think they do. I think they must have at least referred to it once to give that.
Right.
It's funny. Me and Barrett both did pieces on Klopp on last Monday, and instead of transfer
both
committee,
very good, I might add.
Just for that's very kind of you. Barrett's was better than mine, but just for a bit of kind of difference, we referred to the collegiate system of buying players, and people got really upset. People sort of said, what do you mean by that? Has it changed? It's the same thing. That is how all clubs buy players. It's not like no manager in the world just goes, I want him, and then they sign him. It don't work like that.
Dicko, I think several people have pointed out that if Klopp does nothing else, he's really re-energized and brought enthusiasm and offered a huge lift. And he does seem to have genuine charisma, which Brendan Rodgers sometimes it felt that his great charisma was somehow scripted. Is that unfair to Brendan? Or did you also get the sense sometimes that when he came out with certain statements, he'd really, really thought about them before, whereas Klopp seems more spontaneous?
I think Rodgers was sincere in what he was saying about, you know, wanting to improve largely English-British squad. I think he was sincere in the type of football he wanted to play, but I think his problem was that he just lost that clarity of vision by the end. I think, you know, he was trying to be a bit more pragmatic, and he was starting to chop and change. And I just say, I think he just, you know, I think it happens. I think good managers can lose their way a bit.
Was there a problem, in your opinion, with the way Brendan Rodgers presented himself? Did it somehow undermine his messenger's credibility and the way the media filtered it?
There seems to be a problem, which is not one I get. I mean, I'm always and still quite shocked by the sort of antipathy out there towards him. I mean, I find myself arguing his corner with an awful lot of people who, you know, who have been turned off, put off by the notion. I mean, you know, floated the fact that a week or so ago that the FA will take him very seriously as an England contender, and the comments on Times Online were, you know, you must be joking, the guy's a fool, the guy's a fraud, etc. To an extreme which was, say, I find quite shocking. And there is something in his public persona which doesn't grate with me half as much as it seems to grate with an awful lot of people. And if he is to become England manager, that is an issue, because, you know, we judge England managers like prime ministers a lot on presentation as well as results. It doesn't grate with me as much, but if it does draw that sort of polarity of reaction from people, then it's something he's got to think about. Sadly,
he's not English, which for me is reason enough for him never to be England manager. And it's actually, I think, it's even worse if you're England and you pick an England manager from one of the other home nations. Julian,
I think what was very obvious on Friday is what an amazing communicator Klopp is. And I think that in the end, that's probably what cost Brendan Rodgers a lot, is that he lost his way in terms of communication as well. You know, it was never his fault. There was all those, when they have an average game, he was saying, well, I thought we played amazing today. Well, no, you didn't, mate. And suddenly, you know, when before he signed, we had all those experts on the club. Like, they knew all about his life. They saw him when he was at Mainz and all of that. And suddenly we had all those people saying, like, how great he was, everything. But it was the club show on Friday morning, and I think everybody fell in love with him. And he knew it would be the case. And I think he prepared it so well, and he said exactly the right things, and he just seduced everybody, and that was probably the best way for him to start his Liverpool career. And there was then never any doubt that he would start that way.
I think what really intrigued me about Klopp is that, so I could kind of understand, Liverpool's a really polarised fan base. All clubs' fan bases are polarised, but Liverpool's is particularly polarised and factionalised. And I think it was fairly obvious that Klopp, because of his reputation, because of kind of his larger than life personality, that he would unite all those sort of diffuse factions, and that's fine. I wasn't expecting his appointment at Liverpool, which is a club that also polarises other people, to be quite so well received, which I think is testament to how warm people feel towards Klopp himself. But what really interested me was that, and I can't quite put my finger on it, and Gab will shout me down and make me look a dick, but so there's like football charisma. We think of charismatic people within football as following a certain type. And for the last 10 years, it's kind of been the Mourinho thing. Like, you have to be a little bit like Mourinho. You have to speak in these sort of aphoristic statements. You've got to be kind of brooding and slightly sexual. And you've got to be kind of, I don't know, like, there's this kind of intensity to that. Everyone's got a little bit of Mourinho or a little bit of Guardiola. And I think Rodgers fell into that trap, and that's where he maybe lost his way, that he kind of want, everything he was doing was dressed up as something bigger. Klopp has a very un-football charisma. Klopp, even if Klopp was a bank manager, Klopp would be an incredibly charismatic bank manager. He'd be the GP you'd want to go and see.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I agree.
Whereas all of the others seem to follow the same pattern almost.
I actually agree with you there.
Oh my God! Wow!
I agree, actually. Although it's, I mean, and I agree as well. And I think there's something slightly, I don't know, if you were following the sort of Klopp unveiling on Twitter, and it was sort of, you could almost, it almost became nauseous to hear a lot of sort of grown men being seduced.
Well,
quite
actually,
so,
Joe Dickel,
quite
if I can
so
jump
easily.
In on that, when he said, I am the normal one. Everybody came out and talked about how it was the most brilliant thing anybody had ever said. When, in fact, the very brilliant and extremely charismatic Avram Grant said the exact same thing nearly a decade ago.
Exactly. So he was actually recycling an Avram line and managed to sort of pull that off as a moment of genius. But no, I mean, look, I think he is absolutely a far warmer character than Mourinho, who, you know, did, let's remember, pull the same sort of trick of seduction on day one. But I think at the same time, it's going to be interesting. You know, I mean, the fact is, I think Klopp's been sent off, what, 8-9 times in his career. You know, he's a guy who sticks his face very angrily in officials' faces. He's been known to sort of call it on with journalists. So, I mean, you know, I think there is more humanity to him, or I suspect a lot more warmth to him and a lot more charm to him than Mourinho. At the same time, you know, this was day one, and I think there's bound to be some turbulence on the way. I mean, we see him, I think, from this side as this guy who sort of, you know, is like this all the time with a big smile on his face, and actually he can rage and fume and be as blinkered as any manager out there. I mean, they're all mad in their own different way.
Dicko, join me in some time travel here. It's May 2018. We're all getting really, really excited and looking forward to the World Cup in Russia. Klopp is the Liverpool manager, and he has achieved minimum results to keep his job. What are those minimum results in your mind?
Well, again, this is, you know, it's a great debate, because the fact is, on, you know, I wrote about this when he got the job, but Liverpool's sort of, people talk about putting Liverpool back where they belong. Well, you know, if we, you know, we're all bound up with sort of financial power of a club at the moment, back where Liverpool belong is fifth place in the Premier League. I mean, that is where they belong at the moment, on clout, on, you know, on sort of the muscle of the club. So if you get in the top four, you're overachieving. Clearly the club themselves have aspirations for that. They think Klopp is an overachiever, and I think, well, his record shows that he is. I think he will get them, you know, around the top four I suspect, because there's always a bit of turbulence. There's, look at Chelsea this season. Chelsea might be, their blip may continue a while. There's an opportunity there this season to maybe hit the top four. But I think FSG want someone who can consistently overachieve, and that's no small feat.
Right, moving on to FIFA in the headlines again. We had a mini FIFA debate last week. We kind of have to do another one this week because Michel Platini and Sepp Blatter are both suspended. I'm assuming you guys all know the background, so I'll just jump to the present. On Thursday, UEFA meet, and they basically have to decide whether they're going to continue backing Michel Platini. And I think Platini needs to convince them that he will be cleared of these charges. One alternative, of course, is for them to field another candidate, like a Michael van Praag or Luis Figo, who would then step aside if Platini is indeed cleared, or they could just break the glass and wheel him out if Platini continues to be in trouble. And then a week after that is also a FIFA Executive Committee meeting at which they will likely vote to postpone the election and buy everybody more time. Dicko, what's your take here? We can get all sort of wonky and talk about, sort of the politics and whatever, but what does Platini need to do, do you think, to convince the majority of UEFA nations to stand by him?
They want to be convinced in his probity, but the fact is he's done a lousy, awful, stinkingly awful job of convincing us and through us, the general public, that this whole issue of the 1.3 million payment doesn't stink to high heaven. It's the timing, obviously, that's key. We learn this morning that there was never a written contract for this money. It was just word of mouth between him and Blatter, which obviously is, shall we say, troubling with a capital T.
Some of us actually reported that last week, but...
Well, you did. And also there is the fact that, he's put out several statements now with, increasing bluster and outrage, and yet he has not one sentence of those statements has answered the key issue of the timing. He has not explained why it was, in early 2011 that he suddenly remembered he was owed 1.3 million quid. So he can dismiss all he likes the idea that this was a coincidence, that this was approaching a crucial FIFA election. But unless he comes up with a coherent explanation, I'm afraid everyone's going to think it absolutely stinks. The public are not the electorate on this. It's I think the European nations want to stick by him. I think he's got enough sway. I mean, as we've seen with our own FA, that they've got themselves into a terrible hole backing him and don't know how to get out of that hole.
Right, enough of that. Let's move on to some quick hits. France didn't play any qualifiers, but they did get plenty of friendlies, and most recently beat Denmark 2-1 with Olivier Giroud scoring two goals. Julien, is it fair to say he's more important to Le Blues than Le Gunners right now?
No, because he's not. He hadn't scored since March against Denmark at home, so the form
maybe
is not great.
Maybe he should move and play in the Tippeligaen for Michelin.
Maybe, but the form is not great for France. Was like it was not great.
It's not called the Tippeligaen. You made a face. Tippeligaen is Norway. Yeah. What other weirdo Scandinavian name?
It's called Superliga.
So how original, Superliga. That's what it's called in Turkey too.
So his form was not much better with France than it was with Arsenal. However, the brace against Denmark on Sunday night would do him a lot of good, for the coming month with Arsenal.
Big Sam Allardyce is the new Sunderland manager. Dicko, is it an enlightened choice for what Sunderland need right now? And why does he seem to defy opinion so much?
Is it an enlightened choice? I think it's an improvement. I think it's a rational choice. I think he has a decent record at a few different places. People get sniffy about him. There was that sort of nonsense about the Newcastle way when he went up there, which was a load of nonsense. What is the Newcastle way? I think they may still struggle because I don't think they've got a great squad. But if you want to try and get out of the mess they're in, I don't know where else they were going to turn.
Only one player playing abroad has been picked for England since 2010, as we read in Bill Edgar's excellent column today. Rory, can you name him? And is this actually a big deal? And I want to stress, Rory has not read Bill Edgar's piece. Yes. So he's doing this entirely from memory and from his deep knowledge of England squad's past.
No, I have read Bill Edgar's piece. And
he cheated.
Did you know it?
No, the answer is Scott Carson, who played for Bursaspor in Turkey. Is it a big deal? It is to me. I think it would be better for English football if more players moved abroad. I understand that there are lots of arguments about why that wouldn't work and why it's not a great idea, and it's certainly not a panacea, but I certainly think it should be encouraged. Football is a global marketplace. It seems bizarre that English players seem to think they are exempt from that, although there are a lot of young kids who are now starting to go out. There's three or four in Germany, there's a couple in France, who are going to take advantage of the continent's wonderful youth systems and high quality of life.
When you say kids, you actually mean like children, or do you mean players we've actually heard of?
16, under 20, 15, 16, under 17 19, year olds. Yeah.
Well, guys who couldn't make the cut at Arsenal or Liverpool.
No, they tend to have gone from the smaller clubs, high quality academies. There's a couple have gone from MK Dons, for example.
Of Crystal Palace too, Mönchengladbach, Lens.
One at Stuttgart, Danny Collins at Stuttgart. Yeah, there's a few.
Interesting. Absolutely horrid day for Tim Krul. He wasn't even supposed to play for Holland against Kazakhstan, but then Jasper Cillessen gets himself injured in the warm-up. Krul plays and suffers knee ligament damage. He's going to miss the rest of the season. It's another massive blow for Newcastle, Julian, and for our friend Steve McLaren. We're going to see more of Rob Elliott, who has 18 league starts since 2011, or perhaps Carl Darlow, who has yet to play top-flight football. Please assess the loss.
I think it's the worst thing that could happen to them. They could have done without Papi Cisse, without Sissoko, without Colicini, but not Krul, who's, you know, arguably, you know, didn't have the best of start of the season, but still probably their best player, and I think it's a massive blow for them. And I just can't wait to see Rob Elliott playing again.
After the offline Dutch video experiment, we're getting a real live one, albeit in non-competitive games and across the pond. Dicko, you've written about this more than once, but in two different leagues. So please tell us more.
Finally. I mean, isn't it crackers that it's taken this long? The MLS being sort of, you know, go-ahead types are trialing the first live experiments of video replays. The Dutch wanted to do it, but in FIFA, on the FIFA members of IFAB blocked it in their stupidity. If there's one thing that is just so stupid, we've had this debate on and on and on, can video replays work, should it work, how might it work, and yet no one has ever bothered to even find out. God bless them, are going to at least try. They think it can work. Let's see. And let's see how it works. Let's see what can be improved. Let's see what needs tweaking, what needs extra trials. But finally, we might actually have some evidence for this endless debate.
Amen to that. I'm all for testing like this. And incidentally, in case you're wondering, I know people will tweet about this, Dicko is the only person on the show who is allowed to refer to it as the MLS. Everybody else will get shouted at if they call it that. Victor Valdes is reportedly being treated like a pariah at Old Trafford. His locker was cleared out in the summer. He's training on his own at weird times to ensure he doesn't run into any real Manchester United footballers. Now, he's come out and he's stressed that he's done nothing against the club, or that he has nothing against the club. It's evidently a personal problem with Louis van Gaal. Rory, how did it come to this? And should Valdes be getting legal advice? Well, presumably he is.
You'd have thought so. It sounds, if the reports are true, then it sounds like he maybe has a case for constructive dismissal, although people in football are very reticent to involve stuff like that.
Well, and you presume United have that very fancy lawyer, is it Maurice Watkins, right? So you presume that they're doing everything just to stay right on the right side of...
I would imagine so, yeah. It's all related to what happened last season when Valdes arrived on a free transfer. Depending on who you believe, Valdes either didn't have a problem at all and behaved very well, and did what was asked of him, but was disappointed not to play more for the first team, or he refused to play for the under-21s and had a bad attitude and was not particularly pleasant to some of the young players around the what I believe we have to call the Aeon training complex. And who says that? Who refers to the Aeon training? It's ridiculous. I don't even know what Aeon do. But yeah, so that's it, and it seems very intractable. It's very odd. I find it very strange, I've got to admit, that they haven't just sat down and said, right, we'll release you from your contract. Let's do a deal. They clearly don't want him around. He doesn't want to be there. It's bizarre. It's really quite bizarre. They're not prepared to sit down and say, right, enough's enough.
I would guess that maybe they want to send a message to other guys. It was curious, too, because the deal with Besiktas, I think it was, in August, was all set, and then Besiktas did what... right, the version I heard, they did what clubs do in that situation. They said, oh, by the way, you know how we said we were going to pick up this much of his contract? Actually, it's only this much, so you guys have to pay him off and whatever, and then it all collapsed. But I suppose at that stage, United were rather busy with De Gea and Martial and whatever else, and it kind of fell through the cracks. But
very sad. Gab, one for you. I heard something about a mysterious football leaks website data dumping contracts onto the web. What is the deal with that?
Well, thank you for asking, Rory. This is a story which got hasn't gotten that much attention here, but it's the Football Leaks website hosted on LiveJournal, I believe. It started maybe about 2 weeks ago, where every day somebody started posting new details about contracts, about third-party ownership deals, mostly involving Portuguese clubs. There's stuff on there on Marcos Rojo, on Radamel Falcao. It's not that there's anything necessarily, these don't necessarily allege any illegality, although you can look at it and you can maybe extrapolate it, because it's basically a big data dump. It looked to me more like somebody wanted to send a message, look, we have this information and we can disseminate it if you don't do as we say. Lots of mystery and rumors and conspiracy for which you could get in trouble for suggesting who's behind it, but I think most people have a fairly clear idea who's behind it. Interestingly, while the site was still up as of last night, the actual contracts themselves, because you basically the contracts are a big file, so you have to, they're hosted somewhere else in this thing called Yandex, which is like Google Archive, but for Russians, they're not available on there anymore. So those of us who've downloaded everything and keep it on a secret zip drive in an undisclosed location still have access to this information. I'm really curious to see what happens with this and whether the stuff will go back up, but it does, this kind of show you that in football, if somebody wanted to make a lot of stuff public, there are people out there who do it. And it does make you wonder about security as well. Right, that's all we've got time for this week. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guest today, Matt Dickinson, all the way from Vilnius on his roaming, Rory K. Smith here in the studio, and Julian Lawrence. Rory, you're leaving us for 4 weeks.
I am. That is true.
Hugely disappointing. But Julian, you'll be back here next week.
Yes.
I won't be back because I'm going away as well. I'm not going away with Rory, in case you're wondering. But I'm going on holiday. So
you
there.
Are invited if you want to come.
Woo! Let's see. Where are you going?
We're going to New Zealand.
Are you going on your honeymoon?
Yes.
You're kind of a freak show. You're kind of weird.
You
I'm going on my honeymoon. I want to bring Gab along. That's kind of sad.
You can't come for the duration, but if you were in the area, we could have dinner. Be nice.
He's like Justin Bieber, apparently, on honeymoon as well.
Yeah, so this
walks naked everywhere.
But what they're called, they're called buddy moons, where you take your friends with you as well. That, I think, is quite a nice idea.
Wow. No way.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you even consider that because you haven't been living in, if you hadn't been living in sin all these years, then you'd actually be excited and would only want to be with your better half on your honeymoon rather than bringing along random people. So anybody out there on Twitter, if it's Rory Smith Times, if you want to go and join him on his on his honeymoon.
Yes, in New Zealand.
I'll be posting on the Football League's website details of the hotels where he's staying, as well as his travel arrangements.
In Christchurch.
Remember, if you press that subscribe button, you'll hear from us every single week. And remember, you can get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no.
So
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly.
It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.